welcome to Yesterday's News, the podcast that brings you the biggest stories from this week in history. I'm Joe Forrester and I'll be guiding you through the historical headlines from the earth-shattering to the absurd. And my guest this week is filmmaker Matt Bell. Remember, you can follow the show at Very Old News and please do get involved. No tweet is too trivial for our attention. On with the show. First up, we join Julius Caesar as he prepares to get his sandals soggy crossing the Rubicon. Next, we're in the courtroom as Joan of Arc goes on trial for her life. And finally, we head to a muddy field outside Reading to find out how Alfred became the Great. First up is the 10th of January 49 BC, and Matteo Bellini is live on the scene as the fate of the Roman Republic stands on the banks of a small river in northern Italy. Matteo.
That's right, Joe. I'm here outside the town of Ravenna. Now, as you know, I've been following the glorious commander Julius Caesar on campaign for some time now, and this morning we received the news that his supporters in the Senate have fled Rome. Caught up with the great man earlier on to get his take on events. Mr. Caesar, good to see you again. Can you tell us what the situation is right now, please?
It's a pleasure as always, Matteo. Okay, so as you know, I've been in Gaul, really sticking it to the locals. So when I was called back to Rome, I thought everything would be hunky-dory, but it turns out they're rather crass with me. My supporters have fled the Senate, and it appears Pompey is on his way here with an army.
But surely, Signore Caesar, you won't cross the Rubicon, no?
Hey, listen, Matteo, I know to cross this river would be treason. Do I look like the kind of guy who would commit treason against Rome?
Well...
Do I look like the kind of guy?
No, of course not, Mr. Caesar, sir.
Exactly. I'm just gonna sit here and see what happens. There's nothing to worry about.
Thank you so much for talking to me.
Hey, my pleasure.
So that was a machata with Caesar earlier today, Joe. And I get this sense, oh, hang on. Trumpets are sounding. I think something happening.
Let us go with the omens of the gods and the crimes of our enemies summon us. The die is now cast.
Yeah, he's crossed the Rubicon, Joe. Bugger, back to you.
Thanks, Matteo. To cross the Rubicon has entered into modern parlance as an idiom meaning a point of no return. And Caesar's actions that chilly January day set history on a course that leads us to the present day, transforming Rome from a republic to an empire. You know that bit in the boring Star Wars prequels films where suddenly it turns out Senator Palpatine is actually a Sith Lord and dissolves the Galactic Senate? Yeah, he was a bit like that. But let's have a bit of background. So Caesar was born into a powerful and wealthy aristocratic family, and just like posh folk have done throughout history, this meant a life of political and military command. First he did a year as a consul, the highest elected official in the Republic, and after everybody agreed he'd done a jolly good job, he was packed off to Gaul, which is basically modern day France, to subdue all the Asterix and Obelix types that lived there and were being a bit of a bloody nuisance. Not realising the Roman Republic was actually really good in that, so Caesar was sent to make them embrace the power of the dark side. Handily, Caesar kept personal records of his exploits in Gaul and estimated that he left around 1 million of them dead, something he was terribly proud of. This seems like an exaggeration given that the population was somewhere around 6 million at the time, but most modern estimates put casualty figures in the hundreds of thousands. That's the equivalent today of several million Brits being killed in a war of conquest in a period of about 8 years or so. With the barbarians well and truly splattered under the imperial sandal, and now fabulously wealthy from all the money he'd nicked off the Gauls, JC was called back to Rome as the Senate was growing a tad concerned about his cult hero status. On his way back, Caesar discovered his supporters in the Senate had fled the city, and his old pal Pompey was being sent to apprehend him and his army and, at the very least, escort them back to Rome. This is where we joined the story, as Caesar is encamped in the northern Italian city of Ravenna near the Rubicon. However, this piddly little river had a great significance, as for centuries it was the point at which the Senate had decreed no Roman commander could pass with a standing army. To do so was treason. Historian Suetonius, who is a pretty reliable source, having had access to imperial records, tells us of Caesar's decision to advance across the river, shouting the immortal line, "Let us go where the omens of the gods and the crimes of our enemies summon us. The die is now cast." Another idiom we get from this story. Caesar defeated Pompey's army in August of 49 BC and became dictator of the Roman Republic, before being murdered in another famous incident, the Ides of March, on the steps of the Senate in 44 BC. During his life, Caesar also found time to have a child with arguably history's most famous woman, the Queen of Egypt, Cleopatra, whom he apparently met when she was delivered to him rolled up in a rug. Caesar was succeeded by his adopted son Octavian, better known to history as Augustus, and Imperial Rome would last until 476 AD, when the overstretched empire collapsed under the weight of barbarian aggression, something that would have had Caesar spinning in his grave, and Europe descended into the Dark Ages. The crossing of the Rubicon was just one incredible moment and an incredible life from one of the few people who can genuinely be said to have changed the course of history. Next up, it's the 13th of January 1431, and you join us in Rouen, Normandy, where the trial of Joan of Arc is underway. Matt Bell has been watching proceedings unfold. Matt.
Thanks, Joe. Yes, that's right. This is the trial that has really captured the public imagination. Today, the 19-year-old peasant girl was brought in, for once dressed properly in feminine clothing. Here's what happened.
Do you, Joan, swear to tell the truth, the whole truth, and nothing but the truth, so help you God?
I promise to speak truth on what touches your case, but the more you constrain me to swear, the letter I will tell you.
So what do you say to the 70 charges of heresy brought against you?
That which God had made me do, had commanded or shall command, I will not fail to do for any man alive.
Oh, for God. So do you consider yourself to be in the grace of God?
If I am not, may God put me there, and if I am, may God so keep me.
Oh, these bloody French, Joe. Back to you in the studio.
Thanks, Matt. Yes, this 19-year-old French peasant girl was actually a tricky and skilled witness. In answering the last question about being in the grace of God by saying, if I am not, may God put me there, and if I am, may God so keep me, she had, in fact, avoided a trap. As to say she was in the grace of God would be blasphemy, and to say she was not in the grace of God was to admit she had been lying. But lying about what? Let's do a little rewind. Okay, so the French had been getting their behinds kicked up and down the country for nearly 20 years. Henry V had given them an absolute hiding from 1415 onwards, and the French had in fact made him heir to the throne just to stop the slaughter. However, annoyingly, he died of dysentery in 1422, a few weeks before French King Charles VI, who weirdly believed he was made of glass, so never claimed the throne. However, even with his infant son Henry VI on the throne, the English had kept giving the French a good old-fashioned hiding, and by 1429, England and her allies, the Burgundians, controlled more of France than the Dauphin, Charles VII, heir to the French throne, who was, as of yet, uncrowned. It was at this point that a 17-year-old peasant girl turned up and said, "Oi, listen, basically, right, I've been chatting with a few saints and that, and I've defo got God on my side, and I reckon I can lead you to victory. You up for it?" Charles, who was at the end of his tether, agreed. And you know what? It only bloody worked, didn't it? She was promptly sent to Orléans, where she helped lift the siege and was then a figurehead for many other key victories, giving the French a vital foothold in the conflict and allowing poor old Charlie to finally be crowned. However, in May 1430, Joan was captured by the Duke of Burgundy, just picture a Disney villain. Seeming to believe she was some kind of medieval Jason Bourne, Joan attempted escape a couple of times, culminating when she jumped 60 feet from a castle tower and landed in a moat, which she was dragged out of unconscious, but nevertheless. Respect, yeah? Eventually, she was handed over to the wicked English, and in January 1431, her trial began. It goes without saying the English were always planning to kill Joan. However, they couldn't just lop off her head, bung her in a ditch and be done with it, as they would create a martyr for the French to rally around, and we couldn't have that. Then as now, wars are won in the hearts and minds of those you are brutally oppressing. The 70 charges facing Joan were eventually reduced to 12, however, the crux of her case hung around the idea she was a witch. The proof? Well, she heard voices. Okay, I'll give you that. This was the Middle Ages, after all. But what else? Well, she seemed to have good luck. That was quite literally seen as evidence of witchcraft. And, worst of all, she dressed like a man. Burn her! Joan has been seen as a feminist icon, and justifiably so. She was a woman of low social standing who had a huge influence on the power politics of Europe. However, equating her decision to break prescriptive stereotypes by not dressing as expected is slightly stretching a point. Remember, this is a woman who thought saints were talking to her. I'm not sure transcending the boundaries of gender by sticking a pair of slacks on was top of her agenda. The English knew that if they could prove Joan was a witch, they would undermine the entire French cause, as people would question why the King of France himself had taken advice from a heretic. However, annoyingly for the English, Joan wouldn't cave and was masterful when evading questions. Her defiance was so resolute that torturing her was deemed a waste of time, something highly unusual in the medieval period, as nought made them happier than a lovely bit of torture. However, cross-dressing was considered heresy, so when Joan went back to wearing male military apparel, having spent most of the trial dressed in female clothing, this was seen as a relapse. However, later historians have considered the possibility Joan had decided to dress in the clothing of a soldier again, as the fastenings made it more difficult for her captors to rape her. A grim thought. Joan was found guilty and burned at the stake in May 1431. Once the flames died down, the English raked aside the embers to show the crowd she was defo dead. They then burned the body twice more and reduced it to ashes, before scattering her remains in the Seine. However, Joan's legacy was powerful, and that, combined with the overstretched nature of the English, who were betrayed by the Duke of Burgundy, and by now were wondering whether an expensive foreign war was quite the thing, meant that they lost most of their territory in France. Interestingly, English monarchs didn't relinquish their claim to the crown of France until 1800, by which time France was a republic anyway. After the war, the Pope authorised a posthumous retrial in which Joan was found not to be a witch, but in fact a Christian martyr, and the bishop who had presided over the trial was in fact designated a heretic. Joan was canonised as a saint in 1920, but all a little too late for the obscure farm girl who helped turn the tide of the Hundred Years' War. And finally, it's the 8th of January, 871, and Joe Forrester is at Ashdown, northwest of Reading, where an epic battle has taken place. Joe.
Thanks, Joe. That's right. The battle raged here since first light, and I am currently picking my way through the broken bodies of the fallen. As we all know, the noble Saxons of Wessex are the last remaining pocket of resistance against the marauding Viking hordes, and victory today would mean the survival of the Saxons in England. Defeat would mean destruction. Here's what happened.
Things started badly for the Saxons as heroic Prince Alfred, all set to go into battle and send the Vikings scurrying back to their longboats, found his brother, the King, had chosen just that moment to have a jolly good prayer. However, Alfred knew that this battle would hinge on who held the higher ground, and old Alfie used this advantage to charge downhill and drive the Vikings back. When his brother joined the attack too, the day was won. Surely this victory will mean the end of the Vikings in England. Back to you, Joe.
Well, it didn't. But victory at Ashdown certainly gave the beleaguered Saxons a lifeline.
You see, 78 years previously to the day, monks at Lindisfarne Priory in the northeast of England had something of a shock. They were all sitting around playing tiddlywinks, drinking cups of tea and moaning about the weather when a load of sweaty Scandinavians turned up and started murdering them all. How uncivilised. The Vikings spread across England over the next few decades, treating it as their personal piggy bank and plundering their way across most of the north and west. By 871, the Vikings held sway over much of the country, bar the isolated kingdom of Wessex in the southwest. To again use a Star Wars analogy, Wessex was very much the ice planet Hoth, holding out against the forces of the Empire at the beginning of The Empire Strikes Back. The best of the Star Wars movies, if you're asking. The King of Wessex was Ethelred, but it was his younger brother Alfred whom history would remember as the Great, and one of the most famous kings of England. After Ethelred died shortly after Ashdown, Alfred became king. However, he had many years of struggle ahead of him. He was forced to pay the Vikings to make them bugger off. This cunning strategy would be used by later Saxons, and the custom was called Danegeld, literally meaning gold for the Danes. The problem with Danegeld? Well, the Vikings soon realised that the English were so terrified of them, they would give them as much dosh as they liked, so kept coming back for more. As Ali from the brilliant Rex Factor podcast wonderfully put it, it's like paying off a wasp with jam. The Vikings attacked again in 878, and Alfred was driven back to the Marsh of Athelney, literally a load of boggy islands. A bit like Yoda's swamp on Dagobah, eh? Come on. Where probably the most famous anecdote surrounding Alfred's life comes from, the burning of the cakes. It's said that Alfred was lodged with a peasant woman, good lad, who was making some lovely cakes and asked Alf to keep an eye on them. He failed to do so. The cakes burned and the peasant woman admonished the king. This is thought to be a metaphor for Alfred not properly attending his kingdom and is thus probably utter nonsense, but it's a good story nonetheless. Alfred promptly left his swamp, defeated the Danes, and by 886 controlled much of the Midlands and south of England. In 890, Alfred convinced the Viking king Guthrum and many other leading commanders to be baptised, thus co-opting them into Christendom and theoretically nullifying the threat. Alfred's legacy is that of a great king, not just because he drove the Vikings back at Ashdown and again after emerging from Yoda's swamp, but because he was a learned king. Many others were illiterate, and he tried to implement a programme of education across England. He also came up with the system of burhs, small fortified towns which were self-sufficient and could survive a siege, while also acting as a point from which forces could attack any raiders. While England would eventually fall into Viking hands when Canute took the throne in 1016, it's thanks to Alfred and his actions at Ashdown that Anglo-Saxon England survived at all, only to be utterly destroyed by the Normans in 1066, who were descended from Vikings. So it was all for nothing, really. Sorry, Alfred. Hope you enjoyed the cakes. That's it for this week. Thanks for listening. Remember, you can follow the podcast on Twitter @VeryOldNews. Please do get in touch, and I will see you next week.